From the heart of our nation's capital in Washington, D.C., bringing compelling interviews, insightful analysis, taking you beyond the headlines and soundbites into conversations with our nation's leaders and newsmakers, all from a biblical worldview. Sitting in for Tony is today's host, Jody Heiss.
We got a lot of work to do, but we're making progress on all the things that matter the most. On the affordability question, we know that under Joe Biden, the cost of a median-priced home nearly doubled. Now, for the first time in over 5 years, rents are falling for the first time. We got a lot of work to do, but we're finally seeing that American dream of homeownership become accessible again to our young people.
That was Vice President J.D. Vance earlier today commenting on the Trump administration's efforts to address affordability for Americans. Welcome to this Friday, August 21st edition of Washington Watch. I'm your Friday host, Jody Heiss. Glad to have you joining us today. Got a lot coming up on the program, including this. Vice President J.D. Vance spoke in Ohio earlier, where he outlined the Trump administration's economic platform. And Georgia Congressman Barry Loudermilk will be joining us shortly for a discussion on the latest regarding the economy and the high U.S. national debt. Then New Jersey's governor has signed a new pro-abortion law that protects the abortion industry and endangers women and children. Sean Hyland of the New Jersey Family Policy Center will be joining us to discuss that legislation and what it could mean for women and the unborn. Plus, a little bit later, Joe Davis from the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty will join us to discuss a lawsuit filed against a New Jersey school district where religious clubs are not being given equal treatment. All that and much more is coming your way the next hour on this edition of Washington Watch. We'll start today with the remarks that Vice President J.D. Vance gave earlier today at an event at his hometown in Middleton, Ohio. Joining us now to discuss this is Washington Watch reporter Mary Stackhouse. Mary, thanks for joining us and getting us kicked off. Let's start with the Vice President's speech and the trip. What is the trip all about, and what did the Vice President have to say today?
Jody, Vice President Vance spoke at the event, which coincided with a $1 billion investment for the Cleveland Cliffs Middletown Works steel plant. Now, Vice President J.D. Vance's father actually worked at this plant. The funding will come from Cleveland Cliffs and a $500 million grant from the U.S. Department of Energy. Now, during the event, Vice President Vance said that the Democratic Party of his grandfather is unrecognizable today. The Vice President said that the administration is working to reverse high prices and that President Trump is working to reverse 40 years of American decline. Here's what Vice President Vance said at the event.
And I'm not saying it's going to be easy or it's all going to happen overnight, but in just 18 months, we have seen an explosion of rebuilding in the American heartland. We have seen trillions, with a T, trillions of new dollars of investment pour into the United States of America to build new smelters, build new manufacturing facilities, build new mills, build new everything.
Vice President Vance went on to say that under President Trump's leadership, 83,000 factory construction jobs have been added since Inauguration Day. He also defended the administration's trade and tariff policies, which he said are protecting domestic manufacturing jobs. Now, this follows news that the national debt has crossed $40 trillion, which has certainly raised concerns of the impact that this amount, massive amount, would have on borrowing on the economy. Jody?
Let's shift now to some election news. There's a new bipartisan report that shows that both in the states of Iowa and Texas, races now for the U.S. Senate are a toss-up heading into the midterm elections. What's this all about?
So the race for control of the U.S. Senate, it is certainly intensifying. A new Cook Political Report shows that it changed its rating from lean Republican to toss-up in both Texas and Iowa. And, of course, these are typically Republican-leaning states. So in order for Democrats to become the majority in the U.S. Senate, they're going to need to hold the seats that they currently have and flip at least four other seats from Republican to Democrat. Now, a Democrat has not won in a Senate race in Iowa in nearly two decades. And in Texas, it's been even longer. A Democrat has not won a Senate race since 1998. 1988, excuse me. Meanwhile, tonight, President Trump is expected to speak in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, to support Republican Senator Darlene Graham before Tuesday's primary runoff. Jody?
Well, the wheels are spinning all over the country. Let's turn back now for a quick update on the story we've been following and discussing a lot over the past week, and that's the multi-state battle now that's unfolding between the intended parents of a baby born with a rare heart condition and the surrogate who they hired who refused to abort as they wanted. What's the latest on that story?
Well, Jody, the surrogate, McKenna West, she's being sued by the child's intended parents for more than $100,000 after West decided to have the child, despite the intended parents' wishes for her to abort the baby after they learned about his heart condition. West reportedly went to Texas to have the child, where medical experts treated him upon his birth. Now, the intended parents are also suing West for an undisclosed amount in addition to the $100,000. Gabriel is the name that Wes gave the baby. The intended parents have named him Rumi. The child is now with the intended parents, and he's reportedly already gone through the first of three surgeries, which will be necessary to treat his heart condition. So definitely prayers for him. Jody?
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Mary, as always, for getting us kicked off. Let's turn back now to the state of our economy and get a congressional perspective. Joining me now is Congressman Barry Loudermilk. He's a member of the House Financial Services Committee and represents the 11th Congressional District of my home state, great state of Georgia. Congressman Loudermilk, my friend, welcome back to Washington Watch. Thanks for joining me today.
Jody, it's always good to be with you. You know, it's amazing since you and I got into Congress at the same time how things have changed, but at the same time how nothing has changed. It's all the same.
It's really difficult to move the needle. And speaking of that, one of those needles that I know you and myself and a host of others have been trying to push for so long is the out-of-control spending. Vice President Vance today gave some remarks in Middleton, Ohio, basically outlining the economic platform for the Trump administration. And in that, he contrasted the current administration's focus on American-made manufacturing and energy dominance, that type of thing, compared to previous decades, just the opposite. What is your underlying assessment of the economy right now?
The indicators of the economy are showing everything we need to have a strong economy, except for one thing, which is consumer confidence. And I would make the argument since COVID, since the overreaction of the government during COVID, it's very difficult to get consumer confidence back up. And it was exacerbated by the Biden administration and their high spending and Bidenflation. And it's always good to have a healthy distrust of government. But right now, consumers have not really shown that they're trusting that the signals are a long-term improvement in the economy. So it's there's several factors for a good economy, but it's kind of teetering on the brink of all it's going to take is some of these communists or socialists to get into office, or I think the Democrats to get control of either the House or Senate. And I think you're going to see the economy start to plummet.
Well, I would think would definitely happen if they take – and that's why elections are so important. But going back to your comments about the lack of confidence in the economy, I think part of that, at least, certainly inflation, there are multiple factors, but part of it is now the national debt this week topping $40 trillion. Hey, this is the first time in our nation's history, 250 years. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, Jody, when you and I were elected in 2014, took office in 2015, our national debt was an unheard of $17 trillion. I mean, and look at it, it's well more than doubled in just the 12 years I have been in Congress. Now, the current administration has taken some measures that were very good, which is cutting some of the government programs and spending that we don't need to be engaged in, such as USAID, and looking for fraud, waste, and abuse. But we have to do a lot more than that. First, you do have to have a strong economy because we're not going to get out of this debt overnight. It's going to take many years. But you also have to have a Congress that has the will to actually cut spending. I also think it's going to take going back to federalism, to where a lot of these programs that the federal government is spending a lot of your money on needs to go back to the state level. And so I think it's going to be a combination of a multitude of things to get this straight again.
Yeah, it's going to be an enormous task. I mean, we've got mandatory spending versus discretionary, and the vast majority is mandatory, which leaves Congress only about 10% to work with as is, unless something like you just described takes place with some will within Congress. So go a little bit further in that pathway, Congressman Loudermill. What does Congress need to do, and what can they do?
Well, we've shown that the modern Congress is not going to have the political will. I mean, part of it is the people that are being elected. We've seen this populist movement where a lot of the folks being elected are driven by a very thin ideology, which is based off what they perceive to be popular, not off the Constitution or a biblical worldview, which both advocate balancing our budget. And so we do need to look at who we're electing to Congress, but also with these social media, 24-hour news cycles, that's really what drives a lot of the policy these days instead of taking long-term approach. I think the only way we're going to get to a balanced budget is with a constitutional amendment. I think that's going to be a huge undertaking, but I think that's what it's going to take for now and going forward is a balanced budget amendment. I put one in every year I've been in Congress, and it's going to have to be modified. For instance, and you've seen this, every time the budget committee would come out with a new budget, it always had a 10-year path. You know, we were going to balance the budget within 10 years. But the next year when we passed a budget, it was still 10 years. And then the year after that is 10 years. So it's a sliding scale. We never get it down to 9, 8, 7, et cetera. So my balanced budget amendment has been that the Congress must balance the budget within 10 years of ratification of the balanced budget amendment. There's some carve outs there in time of war or national emergencies where you can temporarily get into debt, but then you have to come back out of it very quickly. And so I think that's the real measure of what it's going to take to get the budget under control and get us out of debt.
Do you think there's any appetite for that among Congress? You said a while ago there does not appear to be the will within Congress to deal with these types of things. But now at $40 trillion, this hole is deep. Unfortunately, we've got less than a minute. But do you think that there is a chance that now perhaps Congress may start taking a serious look at solutions?
I think we have to. And there are pockets of people that are very serious about this. I mean, our budget chair, Jody Arrington, he's taken a serious approach at it. But you've got to have a super majority of the people serious about it in Congress as well. And what it's going to take is a public outcry to really start moving the needle.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, my good friend, Georgia Congressman Barry Loudermilk. It's always great to see you. And we always love having you on Washington Watch. Thanks for joining us.
It's great to be with you, Jody.
All right, coming up next, we have a big, big deal coming out of New Jersey, where just yesterday, a pro-abortion, pro-trans piece of legislation was signed into law. We want to dig deeper into that as to what is in this law, what does it mean, what is going to be the outcome of it. And it's probably going to be shocking to hear. So don't go away. We'll cover it all when we come back in just a moment. Stay with us.
America, what formed the fabric of our freedom? What stitched together the hearts of those that fastened the stars and stripes? 250 years ago, our founding fathers penned the invisible words woven within every heart, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Unite with others who will pledge to defend these eternal truths today at Family Research Council's Pray Vote Stand Summit, September 24th to the 26th at Cornerstone Chapel outside Washington, D.C. In 1776, our country declared independence in reliance upon divine providence. In 2026, in the same spirit, we'll declare dependence upon God by gathering for a time of prayer, inspiration, and action. For faith, for family, for freedom. Register now at PrayVoteStand.org.
One nation under God. America's undeniable foundation of faith.
As president of the College of New Jersey, now known as Princeton University, John Witherspoon taught 10 cabinet members, 60 members of Congress, 13 governors, 3 Supreme Court justices, Vice President Aaron Burr, and President James Madison. As a Presbyterian minister, Witherspoon was the only active clergyman to sign the Declaration of Independence. He was a gifted preacher and writer who let his faith direct his political activism, often voicing the link between earthly liberty and spiritual liberty. Witherspoon argued there is not a single instance in history in which civil liberty was lost and religious liberty preserved entire. President John Adams said of Witherspoon, he was a true son of liberty, but first he was the son of the cross. Witherspoon's views on man's sinfulness from birth influenced his belief that self-government was only possible with checks and balances, a belief he passed on to his student, James Madison, father of the Constitution. Witherspoon helped form the vision many of our founding fathers held to: no republic without liberty, no liberty without virtue, and no virtue without religion. And with that, Witherspoon became a cornerstone in America's foundation of faith.
Looking for a trusted source of news that shares your Christian values? Turn to the Washington Stand, your ultimate destination for informed, faith-centered reporting. Our dedicated team goes beyond the headlines, delivering stories that matter most to believers. From breaking events to cultural insights, we provide clear, compassionate coverage through a biblical lens. Discover news you can trust at the Washington Stand, where faith and facts meet every day.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I am your Friday host, Jody Heiss. Glad to be with you, and thank you for tuning in. Just a reminder, real quickly, our Pray Vote Stand Summit is just around the corner, and you don't want to miss it. September 24th through the 26th, Cornerstone Chapel in Leesburg, Virginia, just outside Washington, D.C. Be sure to join us. Get some more details, and go ahead and register. Text the word SUMMIT to 67742. Yesterday, New Jersey's Democratic governor signed a bill into law, S-2260. It is a terrible piece of pro-abortion, pro-trans legislation that literally undermines parental rights. It creates dangerous loopholes for minors. It shields Planned Parenthood and others, abortionists, from accountability. And catch this. It also creates a new crime of, quote, interference with reproductive health care services. Interfering with their health care services is a new crime. So what does all this mean for New Jersey and potentially for other states? Well, joining us now to discuss this is Sean Hyland, Director of Advocacy for the New Jersey Family Policy Center, which is the Family Policy Council in New Jersey that accomplishes at the state level what we here at FRC do at the national level. Sean, welcome to Washington Watch. Good to have you. I tried briefly to summarize the legislation as I understand it. Can you provide some more details for us?
I sure can. Well, thank you, Jody, for having me on this evening. Great to be with you. Let me tell you something. Governor Sharo has picked up here in New Jersey where Governor Murphy left off the past 8 years, and that is being obsessed with abortion and, of course, transgender-related services and procedures. So she signed the bill yesterday, Senate Bill 2260. She's going to say, and those who support the bill are going to say, this is about protecting doctors. But it goes way beyond protecting doctors into prosecuting pro-life advocates and any voices who would be open and critical of these procedures and these services. Now, she'll also say it's a shield law to protect doctors. But Jody, it goes beyond being a shield law because it goes beyond being a shield. It's a sword. It's using the power of government to target pro-life advocates for standing for life, even outside of abortion clinics. You know, for years, the pro-abortion movement in our state and probably in our nation was about increasing access or increasing funding, but now they've changed tactics. Now it's about silencing voices of dissent who disagree and want to expose the harm of these procedures, including the late-term abortions that happen here in New Jersey, and even the transgender-related puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones given to minors in our state. So this bill yesterday, now they created a new fourth-degree crime of interference. Now, again, the worst parts of the bill were removed, and I'll give you some background on that. But still, as it stands today, if a doctor or nurse would come out and allege that someone was threatening or harassing them or intimidating them, even by simply maybe praying or standing outside the clinic, they could be charged with a fourth degree crime, which includes 18 months in prison and up to a $10,000 fine. Now that is tragic, that is scary, and it really chills free speech here in New Jersey.
This is so disturbing to just hear more about this. Now, you've been tracking this bill really from the beginning, and you've been fighting this for years. It's been in the development. So can you kind of track us back, what was proposed originally and what happened to this bill? Is it went along the process until it finally passed both chambers of the legislature?
Yeah, so when the bill was originally introduced earlier this year, the language of the bill went far beyond what it says today. It says if anyone caused a doctor or medical provider who does abortion or gender transitioning services on children, if you were to cause them any type of mental anguish, any type of emotional distress, if you were to cause them to lose business, if you would hurt their reputation somehow, you would be guilty of a fourth degree crime. So they're really going after constitutionally protected speech. And we kept raising and raising that issue in committee hearing after committee hearing. And yet they were completely disregarding what we were saying. Finally, one day the media got a hold of this serious concern. And they went to Rutgers University here in New Jersey to their First Amendment law professor. And he came out and said, this is completely against the Constitution. You can't pass a bill like this. Then the media came out against the bill because they were afraid that their journalists would get arrested for writing a critical article about an abortion doctor or some gender transitioning doctor here in our state. So they removed that language. So thankfully, we won't be in prison just for expressing our biblical views of abortion and of these the dangers of gender transitioning services for kids, but they tried to imprison us. We can't forget that. They tried to imprison us. And if it wasn't for the Constitution, we would be in prison here in New Jersey for simply speaking out against these procedures and thereby maybe causing a doctor's reputation to be harmed, maybe causing someone to change their mind and cancel their appointment to get the abortion. Well, that would now include losing business, causing financial harm to the abortion doctor, and you could have been in prison. But from the very beginning, from committee hearing to committee hearing, starting the Senate Health Committee, we were told, as we begin to give our perspective on the bill, we begin to expose the dangers and harm of this gender transitioning care for minors, the Senate bill sponsors shut us down. They interrupted us. They wouldn't allow us to speak. They told us to stay on the bill. But when the transgender activists and their allies began to speak, well, now the rules changed. They were given a wide spectrum to share their personal experiences and their opinions and everything else, and they framed the emotional framework of the bill. So one side.
So let me ask you this. We got less than a minute. So what needs to happen next? What is next for New Jersey in this battle?
Right now, we are going to encourage our sidewalk counselors at these abortion clinics to wear body cameras. I'm serious. To wear body cameras so you can protect yourself from false allegations of interfering with an abortion service. Because prayer is legal. People can stand outside and pray. But if someone were to allege or to accuse them of going beyond that, of intimidating, harassing them, well, you're going to need some sort of objective record that you can point to show exactly what you were doing and what you were saying. So we are concerned that the state will use their power to really intimidate pro-life advocates, either not to come and pray, not to come and protest, or to face potential litigation here in our state. And of course, there are attorneys that will stand up and protect them if they are arrested. But I want to encourage our pro-life advocates, don't give up, keep showing up, but make sure you use wisdom and record everything you do and you say at these abortion clinics.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Sean Hyland, Director of Advocacy for the New Jersey Family Policy Center. And it's amazing, during the signing yesterday, the governor accused Republicans of trying to control people's lives. Just amazing. All right, stay with us. We've got much more Washington Watch coming your way right after the break.
When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people
to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth
the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature
and of nature's God entitle them.
A decent respect to the opinions of mankind
requires that they should declare the causes
which impel them to the separation.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
That they're endowed by their Creator
with certain unalienable rights.
That among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men,
deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed.
Happy 250th.
Happy 250th.
Happy 250th.
Happy 250th birthday, America.
May God bless America.
Stand on the Word is a simple yet powerful daily Bible reading plan designed to center our hearts, homes, and culture on Scripture. This free resource invites you to read a couple chapters a day to grow in biblical understanding and be equipped to frame current events through the ever-relevant lens of Scripture. Stand on the Word is transforming how thousands engage with God's Word.
We're enjoying, learning, and growing so much as a family with Stand on the Word.
I like how you lay things out and dive deeper into each chapter.
I am gleaning much critical, political, and cultural insight from a biblical worldview that is grounded in God's Word.
This devotional study is phenomenal. It's like being in a small group every morning. Our lives are transformed, and we have shared everything you all do with others. Thank you.
To join these and countless others, visit frc.org/Bible.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm your Friday host, Jody Heiss. Thanks for tuning in. As the U.S. celebrates 250 years of independence, our nation's system of checks and balances still works, just as our founders planned. It keeps federal power in check through three separate branches of government. FRC's own Mary Stackhouse explains why our government is split into three branches and how they maintain a balance of power.
The legislative, the executive, and the judicial. These are the three branches of the United States government. This structure was a deliberate choice by our nation's founding fathers. Having just won their independence from King George III, who had unchecked power in Great Britain, the founders were deeply suspicious of any system that put too much authority in one place. Their vision was to create a balanced system where different groups handled different responsibilities. By splitting the work of the federal government, the founders ensured that no single leader or group could ever accumulate absolute power over the citizens. As senior fellow and director of constitutional studies at the Manhattan Institute, Ilya Shapiro explains, the founders wanted a government that truly represented the people. They designed a system where the government's authority came from the public it served. While Articles 1, 2, and 3 of the U.S. Constitution systematically lay out the framework for the legislative, executive, and judicial branches, the foundational blueprint relies on federalism to ensure that the vast majority of day-to-day governance remains decentralized and localized within the states.
The founders' idea was to create a new federal government that would secure and protect our liberties. And they did that by dividing up power to prevent tyranny, both vertically, meaning between the federal government and the states, and horizontally among the three branches of the federal government, the legislative, Congress, the executive, the president, and the judiciary, which is headed by the Supreme Court.
Each branch has specific powers that it can use to oversee and limit the others. For example, the president can veto a bill passed by Congress, but Congress can override that veto with a two-thirds vote.
The idea was there's necessarily going to be tensions. There might be overlap in terms of what Congress wants to do versus what the president is doing, and then how much should the courts intercede in that. The relationship between the branches, between legislative power and executive power, what kind of regulatory authority Congress can give to the executive branch. branch to then apply other kinds of rules. And so all of this give and take, checks and balances, is there to make sure that the government is empowered to do the things that it's supposed to do to facilitate the flourishing of our nation, to facilitate the protection of our rights and freedoms.
The Democratic Socialists of America are threatening our government's balance of power. Their goal is to do away with the U.S. Senate, defund the Department of Defense, and to replace the President and Supreme Court with an executive and judiciary chosen by and subordinate to Congress. House Speaker Mike Johnson recently blasted socialist ideology.
Communism, Marxism, socialism, all this begins with the premise that there is no God. The communists believe that the state is God. The state is the one that gives you all your rights. And you know what? The state can also take those rights away.
The founders' goal was to prevent the rise of a dictatorship and the concentration of government power, the very principles later embraced by socialist and communist regimes. The search for a new shared faith in socialism reflects a desire for a state that acts as a universal provider. However, this is a major departure from the specific architecture that the founders built to prevent the concentration of power. The U.S. government's model is quite different from what we see in most of Europe. Many European constitutions focus on a list of services the government is required to provide, like healthcare or education. In contrast, the U.S. Bill of Rights is largely a list of things the government is forbidden from doing. It is designed to protect the individual against the state, emphasizing limited government. Recently, we've seen the judiciary branch reassert its role by restraining the executive branch. This year, we've seen federal courts repeatedly block what they considered unlawful actions, such as President Trump's attempts to deploy military and National Guard troops in American cities, as well as the president's order to suspend asylum access at the southern border. On June 30th, the Supreme Court struck down an executive order that attempted to end birthright citizenship for the children of immigrants who were in the U.S. illegally, as well as temporary foreign visitors. The court ruled that under the 14th Amendment, children born on U.S. soil are citizens regardless of their parents' status. This was a significant check on President Trump's authority.
The majority constitutionalized the question. They said an act of Congress can't regulate birthright citizenship. And so ultimately, this did not become a case about the separation of powers. It became a constitutional case. The court took that question out of the legislative realm, out of the political discussion, short of a potential constitutional amendment.
On June 29th, a landmark Supreme Court decision shifted more authority to the executive branch and the federal judiciary while curtailing certain legislative powers. This ruling overturned a 91-year-old precedent, giving the president the power to fire members of independent agencies at will, agencies such as the Federal Trade Commission. However, the courts have also protected the unique powers of Congress. In a landmark ruling on trade, the Supreme Court struck down sweeping tariffs imposed by President Trump. The justices reminded the nation that the Constitution gives the power to tax, including the power to set tariffs, to Congress alone. These cases prove that while the branches may disagree, the architecture of American liberty remains a dynamic, ongoing dialogue between a balance of powers. In the end, this constant push and pull among the three branches is our constitutional framework doing its job, preventing the concentration of power and preserving the rule of law as the true cornerstone of our republic. For Washington Watch, I'm Mary Stackhouse.
So the push and pull, it's all simply our constitutional framework doing its job. You know, all of this goes back, James Madison, our fourth president, he was the one at the Constitutional Convention in 1787 who put forth this idea of three branches of government. It was all based on Isaiah 33:22. Where God is described as our judge, our lawgiver, and our king. Right there is the judicial branch, the legislative branch, and the executive branch, Isaiah 33:22. This is where it all originated. By the way, if you'd like to dive deeper into this and explore the connection between biblical principles and our government, check out FRC's God and Government course. Text the word course to 67742. All right, more Washington Watch straight ahead. Stay with us.
The Center for Biblical Worldview's all-day workshops delves into the formation of a worldview, what it is, how it's formed, when it's formed, what that means to them personally and their churches and communities.
My hope for people when they come to these worldview workshops is that they will come away better equipped to engage the people and the ideas that they're living with and around. And our goal is to give people more confidence in the gospel, in the fact that what God said to us actually is true, actually is the path to happiness and human flourishing for all of us, but also more confidence in their ability to have these conversations and help lead other people to the truth.
For Bible-believing Christians to know what God's Word says on these issues and to learn how they can apply it to their lives. And we believe that the more Christians that we equip, that's how we'll change the nation.
Hey fam, listen, Pastor Sammy here at Lighthouse Church, and I cannot tell you how equipping, how empowering, how incredibly educating this conference has been. And so I just want to encourage anybody that either has not been part of or is thinking about hosting this event, certainly to pastors, leaders, even CEOs for that matter, this conference is lights out. Stand behind it myself. I can't commend it enough. We're going to be talking about this for some time to come.
The culture is kind of squeezing in on us as God's people, forcing those of us with biblical views to change those views or to suppress those views. It's forcing us to engage with issues that we've never had to engage with. And so what this teaches us is what those issues are, what the Bible says about those issues, and then how we can critically engage our culture on these things in a way that is committed to biblical principle.
Visit frc.org/worldview for more information.
What is God's role in government? What does the separation of church and state really mean? And how does morality shape a nation? President John Adams said our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. Join Family Research Council for God and Government, a powerful series that explores the connection between biblical principles and the American government, equipping you with truth to engage in today's most pressing debates. We'll uncover the foundations of our nation's history and why it's relevant for today. Join us to defend God's plan for government, because faith and freedom were never meant to be separate. You can view the course at frc.org/godandgovernment or on the Stand Firm app.
You're tuned in to Washington Watch. Thanks for joining us. I'm your Friday host, Jody Heiss. Just a quick reminder, I've already said it, but make plans now to attend the upcoming Pray Vote Stand Summit taking place September 24th through the 26th. It's coming up right around the corner. It'll be at the Cornerstone Chapel just outside of Washington, D.C. For more details and to register, text the word SUMMIT to 67742. As the new school year is getting underway for students all across the nation, there are certainly battles that continue to be waged to ensure that public school officials are not allowing leftist ideology to drive school policies. For example, just last week, a federal lawsuit was filed against a New Jersey school district that has a ban on outside volunteer mentors for religious clubs, but they freely allow them at every other kind of student club. So joining me now to discuss this and go deeper into this whole issue is senior counsel at the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty, which filed the lawsuit on behalf of the Fellowship of Christian Athletes. Joe, welcome back to Washington Watch. Thanks for joining us. And let's just go more into this New Jersey school district's policy. What can you tell us?
Yeah, sure. So this case involves the Fellowship of Christian Athletes, and Fellowship FCA huddles are student-led student groups that meet on public high school campuses across the country. And what they do is they come together and they do Bible study, they talk about their faith, they eat pizza together. And they often invite to their meetings volunteers from local FCA staff. And these are adults that have been in their shoes before, they were student athletes, and they are able to provide mentorship, and they're able to be there and answer questions and really just to support the club, which is led by the students. But recently, a school district in New Jersey said that they can't do that anymore. It said FCA cannot do this anymore. And the reason is because FCA is a religious club, and that's the language that they used. Meanwhile, if you're a non-religious club, and this school district has dozens of those, then you're allowed to invite outside speakers, outside mentors, outside volunteers. And that's not right. It's not fair. It violates federal law. And so FCA has unfortunately been forced to file a lawsuit about it. And that's what this case is about.
Well, this is just outright pure discrimination, isn't it?
It absolutely is. I mean, it's discriminatory on its face. Again, the rule is religious clubs don't get to have volunteers. Non-religious clubs do. And so at this school district, you've got all kinds of clubs. There's the robotics club, and they have, you know, outside engineers that know stuff about robots that come in and help the kids build their robots. And you've got the the Cultural Connections Club, and they have guest speakers come in and talk about different aspects of culture. This is just how a lot of clubs work. And it's a good thing. I mean, to be quite clear, like FCA thinks it's great that all these other groups are allowed to have the benefits and the insights that outside volunteers can provide. And all FCA is saying is that they want to have that too on the same terms as everybody else.
Yeah, but the district, as I understand it, caved quickly to the atheist group Freedom From Religion Foundation, but not so for FCA, the Fellowship of Christian Athletes. Even after attorneys explained that this rule totally violated the Constitution and the Equal Access law. So what does this suggest to you, that they open up to an atheist group but slam the door on a Christian group?
Yeah, it's really troubling. I mean, FFRF, Freedom From Religion Foundation, you know, it's right there in their name what they think about what the First Amendment actually does, which is to protect the freedom of religion. And they sent a letter to the school district attacking FCA, attacking these kids that have these voluntary meetings that invite outside volunteers to help them. And the school district, you know, that's what they did. They gave in, they caved quickly, and they gave FFRF what FFRF asked for, and really maybe even a little more. And they said, you know, no volunteers at any meetings, period, for any religious club. And that is very troubling. And it's troubling that FCA went to the school district, told it the exact laws, the exact precedents that said that, you know, what you're doing here is illegal. And, you know, in contrast to the treatment that FFRF got, where immediately the school district did what they demanded, they basically stonewalled FCA, and they made FCA file this case. So it's a very troubling turn of events. And, you know, that kind of thing where you just ignore what the law is clearly telling you to do, you know, that can create problems for you in the legal system, of course.
So doing what the law says to do. So let's just put it on the line here. Public schools cannot single out one group for worse treatment simply because they're religious. Is that correct?
That's correct. And there's all kinds of different principles that all kind of arrive at that same conclusion, right? You've got the Constitution, of course, the Free Exercise Clause, which protects the free exercise of all religious believers. And it applies in schools. You don't give up your free exercise rights just because you pass through the schoolhouse gate. And so under the Free Exercise Clause, these kids have a right to freely exercise their religion. That includes meeting with these volunteers who are there to provide, you know, spiritual guidance, mentorship, answer questions about the Bible, help the student leaders when they need help. And so that's what they're doing. They're practicing their faith together. And these student groups have a right to do that, especially if other groups are being allowed to have outside volunteers come in as well. So that's the Constitution. But there's also a federal law that not a lot of people know about, but it's called the Equal Access Act that Congress passed back in the 1980s. And the whole point of this law is to protect religious student groups like the FCA. And what the law says is if you're a public school and you allow student groups to meet on your campus, you've got to give equal access to your campus, regardless of the fact that a student group might be religious or might even have some other philosophical interests. So it's a law that applies to everybody and protects everybody. And so that's the exact scenario that Congress had in mind. That's what's going on here. The school district is refusing equal access. Other groups get access to outside volunteers. Religious student groups do not. And that's just explicitly contrary to what Congress has said.
Incredible what's going on. I want to thank you, Joe Davis, Senior Counsel, the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty, for coming on the program with us. And hats off to all that you and all our friends at the Beckett Fund do to defend our liberties. Thanks for joining us. I want to turn now to another public school policy that continues to get pushback, and that's the policy that allows students to use bathrooms and locker rooms that don't correspond with their biological sex. Now, that policy, frankly, might be a little harder to defend now following the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in late June that upheld state laws preventing biological males from infiltrating female sports. Still, that policy remains in place in many school districts across the country, including those in the state of Virginia, whose Democratic governor has avoided commenting on the bathroom and locker room policy question. At least she didn't comment while she was running for office. So what might we expect with school doors reopening for the new school year? Joining us now for this discussion is Nicole Neely. She's president and founder of Defending Education. Nicole, welcome back to Washington Watch. Thanks for joining us. And I want to start by playing a clip of an exchange back in June between the superintendent of Virginia's Loudoun County Public School and Congresswoman Virginia Fox. This took place during a Education and Workforce Committee. Play clip five for me, please.
Dr. King, do you think it's appropriate for boys to sleep in the same room as girls on field trips? Dr. Spence. Same question.
Thank you. It's appropriate and lawful for transgender students to be able to be treated as their consistently identified gender.
All right. Now, I will note that this exchange took place before the Supreme Court issued its decision on female sports. But still, do you anticipate that Loudoun County and other school districts are going to double down on their bathroom and locker room policies?
Unfortunately, I do fear that that is what we have coming from a lot of blue states, a lot of blue school districts across the country, because the state of jurisprudence on this issue is very murky. The Supreme Court decision that we got at the end of June was in relation to women's sports. And what that said basically is that states can set their own policies on that. So it didn't say, all right, no boys and girls sports completely. You know, it also didn't say unfettered access to everything. That being said, it now means that all the action has moved to states. And in a state like Virginia, which has been purple and is now, as you alluded to, a little bit more blue, unfortunately, you know, Governor Youngkin did not put in place a law. He couldn't get it through the state legislature. And so now we have Spanberger, who is sitting in this. And, it's been interesting to look at universities and school districts and how they have responded to the Trump administration's response to the gender issue overall. There have been some schools, you know, be it Harvard, be it Loudoun County, Arlington County, where I live, that have said, you know what, go pound sand, we're going to go do what we want. There have been others that have absolutely changed their policies because that's kind of secretly what they wanted to do all along. And then there are a lot of them that have been just hiding what their policies are. And so I think in Virginia, we are going to see districts that are doubling down. And frighteningly, I think we also then, where that runs headlong into, is parents have no idea that these policies are in place, be it in bathrooms or locker rooms for their daughters, or also be it for overnight field trips, which is also something that's deeply terrifying. And that many families only find out where that their children have been put into a questionable situation after the fact, because schools hide behind student privacy to not give parents complete information for them to make their own decisions about their own child. And this raises all kinds of problems that fortunately Secretary McMahon has started to take on.
Well, we've both now have mentioned Virginia, and I referenced a little while ago the governor there, Abigail Spanberger, notably avoided commenting on this issue while running for office. But but back then, quite frankly, she was trying to present herself as a moderate. But right. Now that she is the governor, is it fair to say her true colors are much more clear now that she's in office?
Yes, I think so. And as a resident of the Commonwealth, it's something that is deeply concerning to me. I was put on a university board by Governor Youngkin. And so we are waiting for a lot of things to change, be it collective bargaining, be it these gender policies that we thought were going to protect our children when we had the previous governor in place. And now we don't. Were we to have another pandemic type thing, I don't trust Governor Spanberger to do the right thing and allow children to go to school without masks or go to school at all, full stop. And so I think this is very much, this reminds me just as parents send their children back to school this week, next week, that of the quote, the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. It is deeply important for parents to know and ask questions so that they have absolute clarity on these things, so that they are able, again, to say, you know what, I'm not comfortable with my kid going on that field trip. I'm not comfortable with my daughter playing that sport. Maybe we'll do something outside of the school, just so that they are able to protect their child. Because unfortunately, school administrators do not have our children's best interest at heart.
And it's not just the bathroom and locker room issue that parents of public school students need to keep an eye on. Right. There seems to be so many other issues. What else would you bring to the table that parents need to be keeping a lookout for? And what do they need to be doing about it?
Yeah, I think, school safety continues to be a big issue. Even though we just had the Trump administration last week issue guidance to school districts saying stop discriminating on the basis of race in school discipline issues. We have had schools across the country that have been doing that for decades because of guidance that was issued by first President Obama and then President Biden, encouraging schools to do that. And that's how we ended up with situations like Parkland, where schools were not disciplining kids to try and make sure that their racial statistics fell in line with what they thought they should be. So things like that are deeply concerning, as well as, our children still have not recovered from that COVID era learning loss because of school closures. As a mother of an 11-year-old and a 12-year-old, I want every minute that my kids are in school to be spent on reading, writing, and arithmetic, not on identity politics. And that's why I actually pulled my kids out of the public school system here and have them in a Catholic school that better aligns with our values. And so if you don't know what's going on in your kids' classroom, if you don't know what their books are or what their lesson plans are, ask. And if you don't get the answers you want, then we urge people to go to the principal, elevate it, go to the superintendent, go to the school board. You are entitled to all of this information under federal law. And it is important that parents exercise that because clearly, the mainstream media has fallen down on this and they are not paying attention to these things. They think parents who have the temerity to ask these questions are the villains, not the school systems themselves.
Well said. So what is your message? What is your word of encouragement, perhaps, to parents of public school students as their children are returning back to the classrooms all across the country?
It's kind of like when you go to the airport, see something, say something, keep an eye out. And it's so interesting to me. Now that my kids are in junior high, they're a little bit older, but we have these new families that are coming into districts, parents of kindergartners, first graders, and they don't know what it was like in the before times. They think it is perfectly normal to not be allowed into your child's school, to not be, to get an email once a week from your teacher that says, this is what we learned. That's not how it used to be, and that's not how it should be. Children do better when parents and other authority figures in their lives, like teachers, like school administrators, partner together for a child's best interest. Unfortunately, we have far too many school systems in America that treat families like the enemy. They think that they know better than we do how to raise our children. I think back to Hillary Clinton saying it takes a village. They're not your kids. They're not your kids at all. They are not the governor's kids. They are not the state legislator's kids. They are my kids. They are your kids. And so it is really important for parents to have a front seat, because I do think that if a teacher knows, if a principal knows that there are vigilant parents that are paying attention, that will raise a stink, be the squeaky wheel, they will be a little bit more careful about the kinds of assignments that they pull off the internet at night. With all the criticism and attention of the Southern Poverty Law Center over the past year, are they using teach intolerance in schools? Are they using materials that have been provided and recommended by the teachers' unions? Or are they using things that, again, align with our values and teach to state standards? Our children deserve to write. Proficiency rates have fallen off a cliff. Our children deserve better, and our country deserves better.
So in 30 seconds or so, a parent out there senses there is a problem with what's happening behind closed doors with their student. What do they need to do?
We always encourage people to ask questions. We also tell people to try and document things. I think asking for materials by email and writing is always important just to build a record. Be that squeaky wheel, ask for information. And if parents are not comfortable doing that, and I understand there are many families that are like that for a number of reasons, small business owners, et cetera, my team and I are always happy to be the bad guys. We will FOIA, we will ask the questions, we will put people under a microscope. And so that not only that family gets the relief that they deserve, but also other members of that community who have no idea what is taking place are able to make better decisions. I think, unfortunately, the families that are most victimized by this system are low-income families that don't have the time to do so.
Thank you so much for joining us, Nicole Neely, president and founder of Defending Education. All right, that's all we have for today and this week. Have a wonderful weekend, and we'll see you again next week right here on Washington Watch.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council. To support our efforts to advance faith, family, and freedom, please text GIVE to 67742. That's GIVE to 67742. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information, please visit TonyPerkins.com.